you, Lauren. It's great to be here, and I feel a part in many ways, and I trust that by the time I'm finished this morning, you'll feel that I am a part of each one of you. And because of my responsibility right now with Wycliffe in the Wycliffe Information Service, we come to you because we need your help, and every single one of you. And we know that you can be a help because of my own personal testimony and many testimonies of the folks in our organization. We were sitting at the breakfast table, and I found out I have a grandfather here. Many years ago, when I was in the Navy, I became involved in a NAVS home out in Brooklyn, New York. I had accepted Christ as a kid in high school, but that was about it. I never got much farther in the door. But the Lord saw fit to bring me in contact with a NAVS home there in New York, and the Lord, through His Word, turned me on and made my heart sensitive towards His leading. And it was through Ken and Vivian Waters, who were in charge of the home there. I understand that Jim had the privilege of leading Ken to the Lord. And from that day, it's just been one leap after the other and a very exciting time. For the last 19 years, I've been involved in the Wycliffe Bible Translators, and every year seems to be a little bit greater and a little bit more exciting as we see how the Lord is developing every tool that we could ever want to use in reaching the world for Jesus Christ. Now, I've been listening the last couple of hours, this hour, the previous hour and last night, about your program, and I realize that you have the world at your fingertips. In fact, you might feel the world is yours in a very real sense, and the world is a pretty big place. But I'm sorry to tell you that there's one part of the world that's not yours. And maybe it's a very small part, but it's very dear to us. Although you may have 95% of the world, there's a 5% slice here that you just can't touch. 95% of the world, you can go, and you have a portion of the Scripture to use to put in the hands of the people. But that little slice of 5% doesn't have anything of the Word of God. Now, that slice may look pretty small when we talk about 5% of the world. Sort of like our pie at our house. As my boys get older, the slices get smaller that's left over to Dad. And we fight over that last piece sometimes at near bedtime. But this 5% we're not going to fight over. We want all to work together regarding what we can do about it. Because in that 5%, there's some 16 million people. 16 million people that today do not have the Scriptures that they can take up and use. Last night, Doug was talking to us from Psalm 37. And just the last couple of weeks, the Lord's been impressing a verse from that same chapter, verse 31, how that the law of His God is in His heart, and therefore His foot shall not slip. But for this group of people, that's impossible. But thank God we know that when the word is given to them in their own language, then something else can happen, such as Poak Thon, Vietnam. Even though that land is broken up with lots of war and distress and turmoil and so forth, yet the Lord permits us to continue to work there. And Poak Thon, a young man just in his late teens, married and was very first time learning to read in his own language. He had come to know the Lord and was reading little by little and understanding more. And we came along to where the missionaries had to leave. And Poak Thon said, well, that's the end of my reading classes and that's the end of my growth. For he knew that the more he understood of the word, the more he was going to grow. And so he prayed and he asked the Lord to send someone else to replace those that were going to leave. And sure enough, the Lord provided a young lady to go and to continue the reading classes, which are so very important in our work. It's a groundwork. There's no use translating the Scriptures if you don't have someone to read. And so Poak Thon was able to begin to continue his reading lessons. And he thought, well, isn't that great? The Lord answered that prayer. And then the officials came along and said, we're going to stop all literacy classes. No more reading. You all have to get involved in something for your country, and you've got to spend time helping. And so he says, well, we can do both. And the official says, no, you can't do both, one or the other, and therefore you have to work. And so again, he went to the Lord, and he went to the young lady, and he says, Miss, why don't you go and ask the official to permit us to continue our reading classes? And she says, well, I have no pull. I'm not an official. I have nothing to do with the government. And he says, but Miss, we've been praying. We've been praying. So what could she do but go to the official and say, could we have permission? And he gave permission. And so, again, Puak Fon found that the Lord was able to answer. And then came a real test in his little baby. Their first child, a little girl, became very ill. And the people in that area told him that he had to offer sacrifices to his gods. And first his family, and then his village, and his whole clan tried to impress upon him the fact that he had to do this. But Puak, having hid some of the word in his heart, said, no, I've said I'm going to follow. I'm going to follow all the way. And so he prayed. But this time the answer was a little different. And Puak's little girl died. And our worker there wondered what was going to be the result of this. But when she went to talk and try to encourage them, Puak said, oh, don't worry. He said, I asked God to do what he wanted to do. If it was to heal my little girl, it was good. But he's decided to take her to be with him, and it's fine with me, because that's what he's decided to do. Well, Puak was able to stand up to this test because he had the word in his own language that spoke to his heart, and his steps didn't slip. And just the other day, we heard the very vibrant testimony of Dan Pyatt and how the Lord sustained him and his family through the ordeal this past year of losing his son and his daughter-in-law and their child through an accident, and the tremendous test and conflict that went through their hearts and lives, and yet how he was brought forth victorious because he had the word. Well, I trust that you all know about Wycliffe and its purpose, and its purpose to reach this 5%. And in that 5% of the world, you start dividing that up, and you'd have to have a big chart. I have the same problem that Lauren had the past hour. I don't have the chart big enough. Because in this little section, this 5% of the world, there are over 2,000 languages, separate languages within that 5% area. And each one of them needs someone to go and care for them. Such as we say in Africa, someone has to go and sit with them and to learn that they're just people. And they want to understand and be a part. And so we feel that our God-given responsibility is to see that these people do hear. Well, if you're going to do that type of work, you've got to be trained. We don't have a graduation certificate yet. But we have a program. And we feel it's very important that if God's work's going to be done, it should be done properly. And we don't want to have any just secondhand type thing going out. And if a person is going to go out to reach a people who do not have a written language, that means that they can't study their language before they get there. And so you have to study language in its sense, in its essence. And so we have what we call the Summer Institute of Linguistics. Now we have two names. So far we have only two names, two major divisions of our program. One is the Summer Institute of Linguistics, and one is the Wycliffe Bible Translators. And the Summer Institute of Linguistics is older than Wycliffe Bible Translators by a year or so, because it was our first idea to train, to equip people with the art of linguistics so that they could go out and sit with these people and learn the language and write it down for the first time. And so Mr. Cameron Townsend, some 38 years ago, had the vision to begin to train people to do this work. And that first student body of two or three sat on nail kegs in a barn in the Ozarks, and that was the beginning of what the Lord has brought to be today, where we now have training institutes on three university campuses here in the United States. We have a training program at the University of Oklahoma, the University of Washington in the state of Washington, and the University of North Dakota. And they're accredited by the university, and they're staffed by our own people, run completely by our folks. Plus, we have one in England, one in Germany, one in New Zealand, and one in Australia, all geared to train people to do this specific task of translation work. And since we started that first one out in the Ozarks, we've trained some 12,000 people in the art of descriptive linguistics. And this involves some 120 missions. You see, we don't think we've got a corner in the market. We're not the only one in business as far as Bible translation work. Although at present, we're the largest organization that's geared to do translation work in the world. We are also the largest linguistic organization in the world. All of our people who do language work also have to write up descriptive materials in a scientific form to present to scientific journals. And very seldom can you pick up a magazine that's geared to linguistics that you don't find something by one of our people. And we feel this is very important because we want to let the world know that Christians can do top quality work. Dr. Kenneth L. Pike, our leading linguist, the president of the Summer Institute of Linguistics, is a professor at the University of Michigan. And several years ago, he was named as the president of the Linguistic Institute of America, a very high honor. And I don't know how many of you ever met Dr. Pike, but he is a very strong academic individual. And yet, one of the sweetest testimonies I ever heard was last summer when one of our new members said, after having a chapel talk by Dr. Pike, he said, "You know, of all the years I've gone to school and to Bible school and to seminary, I've never seen one of my professors weep. Never saw one of my professors really moved when he talked about the needs of the world. And yet Dr. Pike, professor of the University of Michigan, wept as he talked about what God had called us into." So how thankful we are that God has called men of real academic standard to be leaders and the strength in our program. Well, they're not all professors, though, in Wycliffe Bible Translators. We now number over 2,200 workers in the Wycliffe Bible Translators. And this is a tremendous number. When I came into the program, we sort of knew everybody. It was a big family affair. It was a couple of hundred by then. But now I'm afraid we're almost just numbers when we talk about this individual and that individual. But yet we trust that the Lord will never have us get to the place where we don't consider ourselves as one in Him. Because 2,200 is big, but that's not as big as we have to get. Because although we don't have the corner on the market, although we don't feel that we are the only ones that can do this job, yet so far there hasn't been many others that have really gotten involved. And so as we look out into this 5% of the world, we see that we've got quite a task to go. And just this past 2 weeks, we've been down in Mexico. And amongst other things, we've been talking about goals and about problems and about the future and what we're going to have to do. And we figure that if we're going to reach all the people who want to, we have a saying, we say, all the tribes by 85. And that's not just a slogan, that's not just a few words put together to make a jingle, but this is our heart's desire that we might reach all the tribes by 1985. And to do that, we figure that we're going to have to recruit another 8,000 people at least to become involved in the program that God has called us to do. So aren't we glad we've got computers just to keep track of the people? To keep track of all that's going on. And we look forward with faith, believing, because we've seen what He's done in the past. I've just recently gone through all of our board minutes and corporation conferences right back to the first year that they started keeping such, to make a legal handbook so that we all know what we're supposed to be doing as far as the structure of the program. And I came across a statement where they are praising God for the $3,000 that was sent to them in that 1 month. And that was the greatest amount that they have ever received. And that was $3,000 in 1 month. And if we don't find the Lord providing $3,000 a week now, we're in serious trouble. Because last year was something like $6 million that passed through to keep the total program going. But not only do we find that the Lord has provided our needs financially, but as I've already mentioned, the way that He is providing equipment for us to use today. When we first came in and I went down to South America, my wife and I, and at that time our little girl, who is now graduating from high school, we went down to Peru to live amongst the Cocama Indians. And I figured that this would be my life's work. At that time, that was just about how you faced it. The very interesting thing in all of this is that Ken Waters, who was involved in my getting into the Word and the Lord being able to begin to speak to my heart, had been in Peru and had been working with the Cocama Indians, and he had to leave to take on some administrative duties, and so I was asked to take over his work amongst the Cocamas. And it was our joy to be with these people for about 2 years, and then we were called out to take on other responsibilities also. As a small, growing organization, everybody was picked up to do something that they either had some training in or just looked like they might be able to do it. So we have done a variety of things in our little time with Wycliffe, from actually doing linguistic work to setting up a print shop. I had never even seen a print press before, but no one else had either. So they gave us a room after it crowded out our own bedroom, and they brought down a little multilift machine. They gave the handbook to my wife, said, "Now you run the machine, your husband will direct the program." And it was nice to be able to have that authority. So, and after several years, we soon had a print shop going, and the Word was being printed for the first time there in Peru with the 32 different languages that we're working in Peru. And then we were asked to set up a children's home. Never had that experience and never had a teenager until we suddenly had everything from a second grader to a teenager in the home, and then directing the work there in Peru as a director, and then being sent over to West Africa to see the work get started in a new field. And what a tremendous difference. Because when we went over to West Africa and sought out the areas in Ghana and Nigeria where the Word had still never reached, we knew that from the day that I went up on that survey that it wasn't going to be a lifetime before they got the Word and the New Testament, but it was going to be a matter of maybe 10 years and the job could be done as far as the Word being given to them. Not only was it different in that score, but the transportation was different. In South America, you just don't have roads once you get into the Amazon area, and so it's all by river or by trail. And we went out to the Cocama area for the first time. I got on one of these little boats called a launch, and it was driven by a wood-burning mechanism. And every few hours, it would pull to the shore to get some wood and collect a few more mosquitoes, then go back out in the mid of the stream and go down a little bit farther. We were going downstream, but even so, it took me 6.5 days to get to the juncture where I was going to get off, and got into a canoe and went up into the lake that was going to be our home. Well, out in Africa, I jumped into a little VW, put my stuff in the back, and asked the Lord to take care of me and the car, because I wasn't a mechanic, and took off for the north, and was able to drive right into these villages. But what really, really hurt me was to think that I could do this on roads. I could get in a car and drive up in the north and drive into a village that represented 10,000 people that had never, ever had the Word of God given to them in any form. And so very soon we had 8 different languages in Ghana ready for people to come. As I heard Jack's testimony last night about getting started in Europe or Holland, wherever it was, and looking for a house of 6 bedrooms, We had the joy, I guess we want to call it now, of looking for a house with enough bedrooms to take care of our whole group that was coming to Ghana. And the Lord finally ended up giving us a place with 11 bedrooms. And I thought that was great. And all of a sudden I realized, I woke up to the fact I had 11 bedrooms and no furniture. And I won't go into the story now, but the Ghanaian army finally provided all the furniture for our bedrooms. But we had these eight tribes ready for the people to come. And they started coming. And we not only work around the world, but we have people coming to work with us from around the world. And in Ghana branch, we had folks from Germany, Switzerland, Great Britain, and America. And as they came, I had the joy of taking them out and saying, folks, this is yours. This group of people are waiting for you to do something for them. And they started living in these little villages out in no man's land, in a sense, an area amongst the Vagalas where Marjorie Crouch, some of you folks know her. They live in houses that look like our American Indian adobe houses with a flat roof, big thick walls, and they do it because it gets awful hot there by mid-dry season, and water gets pretty scarce. And I've been there during the time when all the streams, there wasn't even green, murky water left. It was all dried up. And the only water they had was in a well that was dug by the government. And there was so little water in the well that the people, the women, used to go there and sleep all night. And they'd hear this little drip, drip, drip. And in the morning, they got a half a calabash, a little gourd, and they got a half a calabash of water. And that was it for the day. And that's about all they're getting of the word right now, but it's the beginning. And Marjorie now has the Gospel of Mark to give these people for the first time. And you know where they do the work? They do a lot of their linguistic and translation work up on top of the house. They have no problem in telling some of the stories in the New Testament about how what things happened on the top of the house, because that's where these people do. In fact, to get to some of their places, you have to climb a pole and walk over the roof of the houses and then go down into a courtyard that there's no other way to get to but over the top of the house. And in the cool of the evening, when the sun's gone down, they sit up there and they might be working on the grain or might working on pottery or anything, but they all sit on the top and they sing. And they sing the stories of the past to each other. And this is where they've taught each other for all these centuries. And so Marjorie and her partner sat up there and listened to them sing, and now they have a new song that they can sing with them. And when I went there in 1962 and went out and saw these areas, we got openings and we got these people in. And then my wife and I moved over to Nigeria to begin the work there also. And just 3 years later, I went back to Ghana, and all of our people were down from the north in a workshop. This is one of the things that we've developed to help everybody. And they were all down and they were comparing notes and working over things. And in all eight of the languages, now this is in 3 years, alphabets had been established, the grammar had been worked out, and there were initial scripture verses done in all eight of those languages. And my mind went back to just before we got to Ghana, we had the privilege of spending some 4 months in Great Britain. And I was on deputation and telling the folks there of what was to come. And one of the trips, my family was with me. And I have two boys and a girl. And as we were traveling up, all crowded in our little VW plus baggage, we saw a road sign and it said Wycliffe. And we went down the couple of lanes and we found the hamlet of Wycliffe, where John Wycliffe actually lived back in 1380-something. And there was three houses and a chapel. And this chapel was the very chapel that John Wycliffe had worshipped in. Big stone structure and the stained glass, very simple. And we went in there as a family. We got down, we had our own worship service. And we asked the Lord if it would please Him to give us the privilege of seeing some others have the Word of God in their own language, as John Wycliffe had done. And so there, 3 or 4 years later, the Lord saw fit to show us that He had answered that prayer. Well, it's a great thrill. You know, in Romans 15, Paul says he liked to go. He liked to preach the gospel where Christ had never been named. And unfortunately, this is true today, that a person can still do this. And so that's why we come to you, because we need your help, and we need your help very, very much. And we know that you're convinced that the Word of God is the power of God unto salvation. And the people that you're touching, the people that you're dealing with, they're the kind of people that we want to see write to us and say, how can I get involved? How can I get out and do something? I was a Christian when I came in contact with the Navigators, but nothing else, just by name. And it wasn't until I began to apply this to my heart that things really started happening. And that's why Wycliffe appealed to me so much, that they were trying to go out and give the Word and to see what could happen in the hearts of people. And we're still doing that today. Now I want you, I understand that it's customary to get a stretch. And I have some material I want to pass out while you're stretching. So if everyone would stand up and stretch a bit, and we'll pass out some material. Well, we've talked a little bit about what's in front of us, what we feel God has called us into, and what we want to do. But to do this, we need people, as you know. And this little handout, a very simple thing, I want you to take it along and use it as a matter of prayer as well as information. Now, very simple. What it tells you is that we need people. And the numbers alongside the countries means that, say, under Bible translation, it says 10 Australia. That means this year, that doesn't mean next year, but this year we could put 10 translation teams to work in Australia. And you go right along, and the builders, and the teachers, and the nurses, and the maintenance men, and you name it, and we pretty well have a slot for it. But the only thing that my wife and I haven't used in Wycliffe is while we were going to Biola, we both operated the elevator and got our license. They had to have a license in California, and we've never used our license in Wycliffe. But that's about the only thing that we haven't used. Now, the Wycliffe Bible Translators' main goal, main emphasis, is to get the Word into the hands of the people. But to do this, we find we have to have a lot of other personnel, what we call support workers, so that as the person goes out and he lives in the village and he works with the language, he's still human and he still has needs. And when you get some 200 people working in the land of Peru, you've got to have someone to take care of the finances, someone to take care of the buying when you're out, or once you get the language reduced to writing and you want to teach these people how to read and you're really raring to go, then there's no books. Because you don't buy these books, you got to make them. And so on every field, we have to set up a publication department, a printing place. And so we've needed to get offset printers. And to print them, you've got to get them typed up. We have young ladies that come down, their full-time ministry is typing. Now, I can't see that. But fortunately, some really love it, really enjoy typing it out. I remember one person who came down just for a short period of time. And she was just overjoyed to think that she was able to type up the manuscript for the Gospel of Mark in a language that never had it. I mean, her fingers were blessed, every single one of them, as she went along. And this was her part in the program. It was great. Well, also in some of our areas of work, such as New Guinea and Peru and the Philippines, we find that roads just aren't there, so we have to get our people into the interior by means of planes. And the Lord again, in this wonderful 20th century, has given us these planes to use. And so we have pilots. We have our own aviation corps of pilots and of pilot mechanics. Mechanics who, all they do is keep these things ticking. And boy, we want to hear them tick real pretty, like when you take off and you start going over that green jungle and you know there's no place to land for 2 or 3 hours. You want to hear that thing really hum pretty. And we've got the best mechanics ever. They're the tops. And every single individual, no matter what he's doing, they're one in the idea that the word needs to get to these people. He's not down there just to play around with an engine. The pilot's not down there just because he likes flying. The printer's not down there just because he likes the smell of ink. They're all there, and they've got to be there for that one reason, that they know that these people need the word of God. And so, though our family grows and though we multiply, yet we still feel that we're one because of our common desire and purpose. We want to convey this to as many people as we can. And we're only so many people, and therefore we've got to multiply ourselves in some way. And therefore we want to bring you into this multiplication factor. And we trust the Lord will burden your hearts as you deal with these young people, and they want to find out where they can plug in. How can they use the training that they've had? Or here, I've gone to the university and spent 4 years majoring in math. How in the world can I use that to in my service? Well, folks, boy, you let me get a hold of that guy. Math is just the ideal thing. If a guy's really got math, he can take linguistics like nothing. Dr. Pike, our leading linguist, has spent a whole year this past year studying mathematics because he feels that there's a tremendous correlation between linguistics and math. You know, language is just a formula. The only problem is to find the formula. And once you've got it, you've got it. And so a person who can think mathematically is structured to do linguistics. Or a person who's done a general program. The idea that he's been disciplined, we trust, in studies. Disciplined to know how to get something out of material that's been given. And so no one had ever better come around and say, I just don't know what to do. I've been at university for 4 years, and I don't know where the Lord could use this training. Folks, there's something that he can get involved in. Or some young lady or some fellow who's taken a business school or an accountant or a bookkeeper. Do you know what? In Vietnam, where we are trying to get as much done as we can, because who knows how long we're going to be permitted to stay there. When we're talking about goals, our South American area director, Dr. Pittman, says, let's talk about goals in the light of what's happened in Vietnam, where two of our brothers have been killed, one child shot, one now captured by the Viet Cong. If we're going to have goals, let's set them goals in regards to Vietnam, where we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. But you know, we have one of our leading linguists over there sitting in Saigon taking care of the financial books because we don't have a bookkeeper to send over to Saigon. Now that really hurts when we know what's going on. And so we want to let people know. And if we find out that somebody wants to know, we've got a packet all ready to send out to them. Welcome to Wycliffe. And inside the packet, we have general information that tells them step by step, in case they want to know, how to get involved and what our financial policies are, what our major working policies are, what our doctrinal statement is, and then a little preliminary questionnaire at the very back for us to get to know them a bit more and to know just what their questions might be, what kind of training they have. And the last 2 years, we've sent out over 3,000 of these. Right now, we get in approximately 25 inquirers a week. And I'm working with 700 of them that have sent in their preliminary questionnaires, and we're trying to clear up a few things before we process them up into the candidate department. And 2,000 others that haven't answered us, and we've got to write to them again. That's a good-sized number. But by the time you sift these all through the grids and you get down to the bottom, you need a lot more than that. And so I'm asking you to help us get a little bit busier and really get to the place where we don't know when the clock stops and anything else. Now, time's run away, and I want to leave some time for questions. Now, I'm going to be here this afternoon, and I'd appreciate any questions also during that time or in any way that we can help you to inform those that you're working with. We want to be of service to you as we want your help. But possibly you have some questions now, so let's take the next 9.5 minutes for questions. Yes, sir.
What are the dates of the Summer Institute of Linguistics, and can someone still get into that for this summer?
Yes, you can still get into the summer program, and it starts, the date of it is mid-June. Unfortunately, I don't have the exact date here. It's about the 18th, I believe it is, for the linguistic part of it. Now, we have two programs. One linguistic program for those who are going into translation work, and one that we call our support personnel work, those who are going into other phases of it. And that starts 2 weeks later, starts the last day of June. And it's a 6-week course, where the other course is a 10-week course.
Is the Summer Institute of Linguistics the first thing that someone coming into Wycliffe would do if they're going into linguistics?
Right. That would be the first major point. They should be in correspondence with our office before then, especially if they're really anxious, wanting to become a member so that they can get their application papers started on before they go to Norman, where a part of the candidate processing is taken care of. Yes, sir.
You sounded like you screened out way down. What are some of the standards? Can you explain those?
Right. For one going into translation work, we feel that they have to have at least 3 years of academic training beyond high school. Now, this could be in a Bible college, a Bible institute, a university, a college, anything of this sort. But they have to have at least 3 years. Most of them have 4 years of training before they go on into linguistics, because we feel it's more of a graduate-type study. And also, if they have not had any formal Bible training, if it's all been in a state university, we encourage them to take 1 year of Bible training, such as in the graduate course at the Multnomah School of the Bible or Columbia Bible College, or several have a one-year program which really concentrates on the nitty-gritty of the Scriptures, you know, just the real stuff, not how to teach a Sunday school class or how to use final graph material or this type of thing, but really what the Word is all about. And in a year's time, they can have a pretty good hold of it. Besides this, those are the main elements. Then they go through our training course there at the summer program, and by the end of the summer, they know whether they're going to be able to handle linguistics or not. And it's we often surprise them to the fact that they can do it. When we think of linguistics and all this, it sounds pretty high-powered stuff, you know. But we're not looking for linguists or Bible translators, to tell you the truth. We're looking for people who are willing to be trained to do linguistics and Bible translation work. Yes, sir.
How much fluency do they need in the English language?
They need to be able to handle English. In our school in Germany, in fact, we have folks, as I said, from Switzerland, Germany, Japan, Korea, and what have you. They all have to be able to be fluent in English. Now, some of them, like in our German school, take the course in German, and then they may not have enough English, and then they take a year of English help in England or something before they go out. Yes, sir.
What percentage of people who go into the linguistic school actually are able to have enough facility to be able to do translating work?
Let me answer that in a roundabout way. Because of the years of experience that we've had, an individual now, an average person, who is able to cope with the linguistic material that's given to him in the summer program, and not necessarily getting straight A's, but coming out maybe with a B average or a little bit lower, not much lower, can go out to the field, and because of our development of workshops and consultants, All along the way, they're getting on-the-job training so that you are not left to your alone to do this job. Now, when we went out, that was it. I mean, this was, there are the Kakamas, go sick them. And that was yours. But now, at the right from the very beginning, you go out and you begin the language, and along comes a dear, beloved companion consultant. And he says, okay, now, what have you found, and what are your problems? And month by month, you make a structure what you're doing. And then periodically, you have a workshop where the folks come in from various possibly related languages, although they're not the same. There's some cognates that are similar, and they work together. So by this means, an individual can do it. Now, unfortunately, of some of these 12,000 people that we've trained who are in other missions, they've tried to do it on their own and have found that it's impossible, and it's really hurts to see someone who goes out and really on fire to do something. He gets out there and he gets started and he doesn't make a success of it because he hasn't had the help, and therefore the mission says, well, it's impossible. Scratch it off. Don't even try it. And this is one of the real joys when we went to West Africa, of finding a lot of people who had been trained and been wanting to do this and couldn't do it. And then we invited them into our workshops. And every workshop we had four or five different missions represented. And it was a real spur and encouragement. It was really great, refreshing. George?
I have two questions, if I may. First one is, in the field of some of this support personnel, along with the proficiency and the skill that they would be adding to your group, what other requirements do you have, generally speaking?
Mm-hmm. Well, as you said, it's... Along that line, it's more of the skill that they have to offer. And if they have not been formally trained, how many years of experience have they had in that particular work? And also, we feel that they need to have some form of Bible training as well. And they can either have taken this, say, in a series of correspondence courses, either a navigator's work, if they really dug into it and really is meaningful, or a correspondence course from Moody. But if possible, we also encourage them to take a year of formal. But that's not always, they're not always able to do this because so many of these people are in their 30s or 40s and they have a family and it's impossible to go on back into school. So we give a Bible examination to everyone that's coming into Wycliffe. And if they do not make average or above average, then they are asked to take on some correspondence work before they go to the field, say during their interim between jungle camp and all of this. But besides their skill, the Bible training is most important. We do not have an age limit. I got a letter the other day from a couple. Both man and wife are school teachers. And they said, we don't know whether we should write to you or not. He says, we were just turned down by a mission last week because we were 33 years old. Boy, did I write to them quick. There's no age limit, and the size of family isn't all that important as long as you really have something that's valuable that can be involved in.
The other question is...
Yes, right.
This is going back to 5%. Do you find that 5% of the population is growing proportionately to the rest of the growth in the world?
Well, that's a good question. In certain areas, yes. In certain areas, no. We know of areas where the people are literally killing themselves off. They have no purpose for living, and they say, why bring any more people into the world to live in this situation? And we find this type of groups in Latin America as well as in Africa. Whereas, again, you will find areas where they are multiplying just like anybody else. And the numbers getting not smaller but larger. But this is, of course, really fascinating to see the power of the word to take effect in a group of people, like one group in Mexico, where they actually were not permitting any child to live. And then the word taking effect into the hearts of the people. And for the first time in something like 15 years, the census was higher than ever before. It was beautiful. Yes, sir.
Does the amount of languages in the world increase as the years go on? Like you have about 2,000 now. Will that increase considerably?
Well, it might increase, not necessarily that there are more languages, but we happen to find them. Such as when we went to New Guinea, we had no idea that there was something like 600 languages in New Guinea. Because of the rugged terrain and the little pockets, the people who've been isolated from anybody else, and the pocket here, and just a few miles away, another pocket, and there's no interchange, and no, they just can't understand each other. So when we first started out, Wycliffe's goal was to reach the 1,000 languages in the world. Then we had to raise it to 2,000. But we hope that one of these days we can get to the place where we're not talking about quite that number and that we've really reached them. And we believe we can. Yes, sir.
When you say translation teams here, are you speaking of married couples? And do you take single men and women? And if so, how do you send them out?
I don't know what we'd do without our single gals. They're terrific. They're great. In fact, sometimes I wonder whether we shouldn't have more of them than the couples. We take single people. We have single girls. We have single fellows. We have couples without children. We have couples with lots of children. You name it, we've got it. And they go out in twos, either two single girls, two single fellows, or a married couple, and they are allocated to a particular area. Depending upon the size of the tribe, they might eventually have a couple of teams in the particular area, but they are sent out in twos. Yes, sir.
How many languages a year are you adding? One question. Second question. Out of 1,000 applicants, about how many end up with Wycliffe as translators?
Well, right now we're working in 445 different languages. And I believe this last year they said something that we are allocating about a language a week. But I think it was pretty close to that. Because our recruitment department is very new, just since August, Wycliffe has grown like Topsy. And the department, the candidate department, was sort of holding on to recruitment in a sense, in that they were taking names, and that was about all. I can't answer that last question as to how many of the number that apply finally get out. But I know it's a very small number, because I have, out of these 3,000 I'm holding on to, I have about 2,000 that haven't answered back, 700 that that have but haven't gone any farther, and 300 that we've probably about a little over half of those came through. So now, if this is the picture that's always that, but I can't. I'll tell you another year or so what happens. But last year, I think it was about 180 new members that we received, and we need to. We're looking to the Lord for a good 200 this year. And we've got to keep stepping that up to where we're taking in some 300 or 400 a year. And we've got it all set up. We've got our training programs. We've got our schools. And we can handle that many. All we need is the people. Yes, sir.
When do you feel that you've finished with the language? And how many languages have you finished?
We feel that to say that we've completed a program, we need to have at least the New Testament translated. We need to have established readers, a reading program where people are learning to read and have read, and that there is a Christian community going. We work on the principle of an indigenous program. That means from the very beginning, our people do not take the responsibility to preach or to evangelize. We do the translation work. We work the person-to-person contact. But as far as getting out and preaching or contacting, we feel it's up to those people themselves. And so as we work with a man on the language and translation work, and the Lord finally sparks his heart and he believes, then we say, all right, now, what are you going to do? Share it with your people. And so by the time the New Testament is done, you should have men who are leaders in the tribe giving out the word. Now, as far as how many are completed, we have finished work in about two of the areas in Mexico where they now have the translation work. They've got established Christian communities, and the people have actually moved away and gone to Colombia, South America, to begin another work. And in Peru, amongst the Piros, the work is done. Now, if we leave them, it doesn't mean that we've cut them off. We have someone that goes back once in a while to see how things are going, or we put them under the wing of an existing mission or church program, such as in Peru. The group has come underneath the wing of the Evangelical Church of Peru, and this is good, so they have some interplay and some way to develop. Yes, sir?
Can you share a little bit about what's happening up in Russia now?
Well, our general director, Mr. Townsend, Uncle Cam as we all call him, and Elaine, but don't call her Aunt Elaine because she's younger, they've been in the USSR. They were there for some 6 months or so, and they were invited in by the Latin American Institute of Culture or something of that sort, and they went in to make a study of the languages in the Caucasus, down in the southern part there. And they were introduced to the officials of the Academy of Sciences, the top institute in the USSR. And Uncle Cam told them that they were interested in the language situation, in linguistics, and in translation work. And they said, well, you can come and look, but we have no need for that type of work. We have linguists, and we have done the linguistic work that's necessary on these languages. And it's very true that they do have linguists. They have a very strong core of linguists in USSR. But Mr. Thomas says, well, that's good, but I don't believe that people have the Bible. And the man says, well, we don't think they need it. And Mr. Townsend said, well, we feel that every man should have the right to have the word and to do with it as they wish. And they permitted them to go to the Caucasus, and they've had a very interesting time. And also Ethel Wallace, who some of you might know by some of the books that she's written, she went out along with them after a while. And they found that in a good many of these areas, the language work has been done, but at present, no scriptures available to them. So his visit was ended, and the Academy has agreed to permit an agreement to be made with our Columbia branch in South America to exchange students, and maybe, say, like 3 or 4 students for a year. So it's just a little bit of the door, it's just a little bit open, and that's about as far. But we want to keep it there and to see what's going to happen. And these three will go over, and one idea that Uncle Cam has, and he is a man of many ideas, you never can keep up with them, never mind ahead of them. And he feels that maybe the Lord would permit us to do something like was done in the early days in China, where actually, some people are hired to do translation work, and then somebody checks it over to see whether it's really good. And if this is the only way that we can get it done in the Caucasus, well, let's do it that way. But we just don't know. We're just going a step at a time, and so far, that's the step.
Do you think it's pretty well documented that Khrushchev became a Christian?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's depends upon how many steps you want to take to call it documented. Uncle Cam and Elaine had left USSR and were in England and went to a brethren assembly there, and a gentleman at that meeting got up and read a letter. And it was from a man in the USSR who had attended a church service in which a man walked in and gave a testimony that through his wife's reading of the scripture and through the prayers of many people, that he had come to trust in Jesus Christ. And this man said this was Khrushchev. And later on, we heard another report through Australia of the same thing. Now, we are not printing this in any of our translation magazines and so forth until we get some more concrete information. But as far as you know, this is what's happened.
Change the subject back that way.
along with Khrushchev and Tiny Tim, I was really making progress. I guess you heard that Tiny Tim received Christ a couple months ago. You know who Tiny Tim is.
That weirdo?
What? Yeah, a little bit, but we'll stick with Wycliffe right now. Jack, here we are. We'll be going back to areas now, and say this summer there'll be summer training programs a lot of these will be involved in, with anywhere from 45 to 70 college students. We'll have conferences in the fall. Now, what steps should we take to get this information that we've been getting from you before these people, so either now or later they could follow through? What can we do now, step by step, to put this in practice?
Well, the first step is to take my name. I'm Jack Henderson. And I just love to hear from you anytime. And we can do two things. One thing, we can get literature for you to put in the hands of these people or to let them get exposed. Or second, we can see that a representative of Wycliffe is with you. Not necessarily to twist anybody's arm, but to be there to give information and to answer questions. We're as excited as you are to get folks involved in the Lord's work, and whether it's Wycliffe or not. But if we can be there to inform them of the opportunities, we want to let these kids know that when they are up to the place where they want to know what to do, that missions is an option that could be theirs. So up in the front here, I have quite a few of these, our latest handout, What Should Your Mission Be? And it gives a pretty good program of what Wycliffe is. And I'd like to have as many of you take one of these, maybe there's enough for one of each couple, and to look it through. And this is the type of material that we could send to you that you could have. And now if you're having a group, such as a conference or in the fall or something, and you want to, if you could use a Wycliffe representative, we'd be thrilled to try to arrange it. I understand you've cut up the United States into three pieces. We've cut up the United States into five pieces. We just can't take quite as big a bite as the navigators. And we have representatives in each one of these five areas. And there are certain people who are doing deputation in those areas. And if we can be of service to you in any way, please let us know. The easiest way is to write to me, Jack Henderson, Post Office Box 1960, 1960. That's when we moved to that office. Post Office Box 1960, Santa Ana, California. The address is actually on this personnel needs list right at the bottom there on the back page. And all you have to do is add the name Jack Henderson, and we'd be thrilled to work anything out. And then any of the kids that really get excited and turned on and want to know more, they can write to us, and we'll send them the information and get started. Now, we prefer that the individual writes. We found, as I've gone through the records, that the ones that we have most that we cull out are those who are referred to us by somebody else. Somebody writes in and says, I'm sure George would really be great, and George doesn't even think of us. But if you say, okay, George, if you really think this is it, you write to him. Then he has to make an initial decision whether he wants to write or not. And that's great. And whether he continues or not, at least we've gotten in contact with George personally, and he knows what we're about, and he knows what we're about. And you know, even though these 2,000 or 3,000 I have on my list, they may not all come into Wycliffe, yet they're all getting exposed and getting the idea that there is a need. And just as much as we need all these 10,000 people in the field, we need 100,000 standing behind us in prayer and in their giving. So thanks a lot, and I trust I'll see you all this afternoon sometime.